We are going to start today by speaking with John Ellis, founder of Investorist. I did John's story for the Entrepreneur Journey series. I don't know if some of you may have read it already. Investorist is an Australian company, and it's a very interesting story that I wanted to showcase for you and invite John to introduce him to you so that you can learn from his journey. Welcome, John. It's great to have you here.
Thank you, Sumana. It's great to be here as well.
So tell us first about Investorist. What do you do? Let's set the context with your business first.
Sure. So we're the world's first global new build MLS. So what that means is we connect property developers and master brokers globally with the agents, advisors, wealth creation companies that sell their inventory. We have 10 offices in 5 different countries. We started in Australia and we've got offices all around Australia. I'm currently in Miami, where our head office is for the USA. We're also in London and China and Southeast Asia.
And tell us a little bit about the business model of your business. Who's the customer? Who buys? Who pays? How do they pay? What do they pay?
Sure. So we have really, I suppose, three customers. We've got the sell side of our marketplace, and that is property developers and master brokers. And when I say master brokers, in the USA, some of our key customers are people like Douglas Elliman, Corcoran Sunshine, Severa Real Estate Group, and then I look at developers like Related, Trump Group, here in the States are customers of ours. And then on the other side of our marketplace is our demand side. Demand side is typically, there may be realtors, or there may be migration agents, there might be wealth creation companies, and they tend to be interstate or international. So we've got about 800 companies use our platform throughout China. We make our money, about 60% of our revenue is from our marketplace. So that is companies like Douglas Elliman, Severa, and Corcoran Sunshine listing their inventory on our marketplace to be purchased or found by brokers on the other side. And 40% of our revenue is a software as a service model, and that is companies around the world use our technology to run their own internal marketplaces and run their own internal sales. So we now have over 300 companies that use that software. One that's quite significant is Knight Frank. Knight Frank use our software to run all of their offices globally.
So you have both a private marketplace, which is a series of private marketplaces that are run on behalf of, white labeled on behalf of major developers. And then you also have a public marketplace, which are developers, real estate developers, as well as the buyers of real estate and all the associated players in that ecosystem that are on a public marketplace model. Correct?
Yeah, that's almost correct. So all of our marketplaces are closed because they're business to business, not business to consumer. So everyone that accesses our marketplace is a property professional, pays us a fee, and is able to log in through our infrastructure. But we also, yes, have these private marketplaces, these white label portals. But the significant part of our private marketplaces is that they do connect with each other. Very much like a Google spreadsheet, a Google Drive spreadsheet allows you to share documents with each other. Our platform allows project marketers, master brokers to co-broke on property development projects, which is very significant.
And the way you make money, of course, in the white label case, it's a software as a service business model. In the B2B marketplace, public marketplace, what is the model? Is it commissions on the properties that are bought and sold?
No, we don't take any commission, which is unfortunate because we have more than $50 billion worth of inventory on our system that's transacted through there at the moment. But we charge based on listing fees, and we also have a membership fee. So we have monthly fees to have your project live in our marketplace, and we have monthly fees to allow you to access that marketplace.
All right.
And we have more than 6,500 different companies subscribing to that service, so we're a low-cost, high-volume solution.
Got it. All right. So I know you have a very interesting beginning story, and we, you know, our work and our audience is very largely very early stage entrepreneurs. So I'd like you to tell us a bit about how you started and how you got your business going, how you built your business.
Yes. So I own an advertising agency. I worked for a large property developer in Australia. I then started my own. I was a terrible, terrible employee. And then I started my own advertising agency. In that advertising agency, we built lots of small websites for property developers taking their projects to market. Those microsites had a glorified Excel spreadsheet on the back end of them that allowed the developers to manage their inventory. Then I started building more sophisticated versions of that, and I came up with the idea of Investorist. I think, Sramana, the part of my story last time that you particularly liked was my naivety as an entrepreneur, where I thought I would be able to build a really great piece of technology, and so I spent more than $1.5 million building a really great piece of technology and just expected people to use it, which they, of course, didn't. And so I bootstrapped that myself, and then I bootstrapped my first 45 clients before I realized very, very quickly that if I didn't get some equity and some other investment, it would be a very short journey for me as an entrepreneur.
So talk a little bit about that bootstrapping period. Did you keep the advertising agency going at that point, and you were subsidizing the development of this technology?
Yeah, absolutely. I actually still have my advertising agency going now, but thankfully it doesn't subsidize the business anymore. But at the time it was. So I had at that time 24 people in my advertising agency plus 12 in the tech company that I'd bought. So 36 odd employees. And it was quite a profitable advertising agency. It was good.
Obviously.
Every single cent that I made went into Investorist. So then
you said you would subsidize also 45 customers, the first 45 customers. Talk about what those customers did, and why did you have to subsidize them, and why do you call them customers if you had to subsidize them?
What do those customers do? Well, they didn't do anything. Because I made the mistake of giving my software and my product away to them for free. So I went out and employed two salespeople and went around signing up customers, which weren't customers. They were just people that I knew in the industry, and basically gave them my software and gave them the ability to list, and expected that because I gave it to them for free and it's really, really good and I'd spent a lot of money on it, they would value it. And of course, they just didn't. I think that's rule 101 in building a tech company, isn't it? Don't just give it away for free and expect people to use it. People don't value what they don't pay for.
Yeah, and free users are not customers. There's a big terminology problem here, and that I want everybody to be aware of. And the story that John is telling is that he mistook free users as customers. Free users are not customers. They're free users. They're free riders mostly. So unless people are paying for the value you offer, you don't call them customers. They're free users. So what was the turning point? This, you know, 45 free users that you thought were customers, and what flipped in your head that you did things differently when you reached the point where you had to go for the 46 free users?
Yeah, I guess survival flicked in my head, Sramana, and I realized that my free users, because it was free, they weren't even using it that much, and my 46th was just going further into a black hole, and so I realized very, very quickly that I had to start charging, I was also very, very lucky. It was around that time that I got my first investor, which was Salter Capital, and they invested in the business, and their comments were, we really like what you're doing and we love the technology, but this has to change. And the first thing that has to change is people have to start paying. And we did that. So they invested and we started charging them. I actually started charging people before Salter Capital invested.
These 45 free users were open to paying for your product?
No, they certainly weren't. So those 45 free users, they most of those didn't pay at the start. So it was basically the 46th user, they paid, and the 47th, and the 48th, and the 49th,
and
so on and
so forth.
And
what was the difference in terms of the characteristics of the first 45 users versus the 46th, the 47th, and the 48th user? Did you go for a different segment, different type of user? What was different about what you went after to be able to get paying customers?
Absolutely nothing. Absolutely nothing. My product was exactly the same. My pitch was exactly the same. The customer I was talking to was exactly the same. The only thing that changed was that I gave my product value. So when you're giving something away for free, you're not necessarily giving your product value. But when you charge for it, then you're giving it inherent value. And it was that process of providing my product a value proposition that made all the difference.
And you were, at this point, you were selling the SaaS product, the private marketplace offering?
At that time, I hadn't even thought of my SaaS product. I was only selling the marketplace offering.
I see. So these were membership. People were willing to pay memberships into the public marketplace.
Yeah, people were prepared to pay listing fees, and people were prepared to pay memberships.
Okay.
And I think one of the things about building a marketplace is it's very expensive to build a marketplace. If you're like me and you make that foolish mistake and spend all of your money on developing your software, then you'll end up with very, very good software and a very, very poor marketplace because you can't afford to build it. And I'd hoped at the time that because I was giving it away for free, that people would instantly use it. That is not true. And I don't know of many companies that have been able to achieve seeding their marketplace by that approach. I think that what you need to do when you're building a marketplace is invest heavily. What I ended up doing that got success in my marketplace is I invested heavily in salespeople and heavily in marketing in the region and regions that I was targeting. So I addressed initially my market of Melbourne, and I put a lot of money into acquiring the developers and the master brokers in Melbourne, Australia, that would be selling an inventory. And straight away, I opened up markets, buy-side markets, demand markets in China and Southeast Asia, and with people that those developers and master brokers hadn't met before. So I instantly delivered them some value within weeks, and then the repeat listing started, and I started to get the first signs that there would be a sustainable marketplace business there.
So you tapped into the trend of Chinese and Southeast Asian buyers buying into the Australian property market, and these buyers were harder to reach for the Melbourne developers, and you kind of solved that problem of bringing them into this marketplace, and that was the draw for both sides of that marketplace to pay the membership fee for your portal.
Yeah, absolutely. For the developer, yes, they don't know who these agents are, and they're very, very hard to meet, and they're very hard to find. But more so for my members, the agents on the other side of the world, they have language barriers. The property developers may come into the market once every 5 years, so long-term relationships are hard to build. And And really, I guess the simplest parallel with my product and something else in the market is we're kind of like the Expedia for off-plan new build development. So you can go on there, find a particular unit and reserve that online. And that's something that was never in our market before. So it was a very, very simple proposition for the agents in China and Southeast Asia to sign on. And once that marketplace was seeded, it was a no-brainer for the property developers as well.
So, folks, those of you who are listening, pay attention to what we have discussed so far, and I'll call out precisely what I want you to underscore. In this story that John is telling, there was a lot of experimentation. He was a first-time entrepreneur, and the good news was that there was an advertising services company that was producing a lot of cash, which was subsidizing all these experiments, because there were a lot of mistakes early on, as John is telling you, that he spent too much money on technology development and not enough to seed the marketplace. So by the time he got to seeding the market, and then he gave a lot of stuff away for free, et cetera, none of which were great business moves. But eventually, once all this started to come together, and the cash that came out of the advertising agency services business was very helpful. So bootstrapping using services is a very, very effective and common way that a lot of entrepreneurs have mitigated this, you know, early experimentation, early mistakes phase. And it's something that has worked for numerous entrepreneurs. So those of you who are looking for, you know, strategic moves in terms of bootstrapping, service is one of the most obvious ways to go. John, you did something really interesting at this point, which is raise equity money from your customers. Tell us more about that. I love that.
So initially I thought I would raise money like everyone typically raises money from a VC or a bank or an investor in tech companies. And I thought that was the path that I should take. And that journey was horrible. I think people can read about that journey in your story, so I won't elaborate on it. But what did happen was during a presentation with Salsa, they said to one of my salespeople, "Hey, you're looking for funds because I like this business." And the salesperson said, yeah, we are. And put me in touch. And then they invested. And they invested because they really understood what we were doing. They understood what we were trying to achieve. And most importantly, they really understood the value. And we operate in a niche. It's a massive niche. So in Australia, the industry is worth $50 billion alone. In America, the industry is worth about $500 billion. So it's a massive niche, but it's still a niche, and it's something that people don't know about. And when I was talking to normal VCs, normal investors, they didn't get my domain, but my customers really got my domain and really got my value proposition. So we raised money from our customers round one. Then we raised money from our customers round two. So seed was customers, and what was probably seed plus was customers again. And across that period, we raised about $4.5 million. We're now into what is probably considered an A round or maybe a B round. We're about halfway through that. We've raised close to $4 million now, again, from our customers. And we're now out raising the last $4 to $5 million the last $3 million of that round. And again, from customers in Australia, China, and the USA.
Very interesting. So your equity investors are all customers, and they are deeply incentivized to promote your value proposition to the industry, so to speak. You have great advocates who are going out and talking about why they're using your product and how they're using your product and what value they're getting from it.
Well, I think that's true. It's interesting. My investors, whilst customers, they're not my biggest customers. The majority of funds I've raised from customers. I've raised some funds from friends of customers, but that's quite limited. Most of it from customers. They're not my biggest customers, and so therefore, I don't believe it drives much usage of my platform. Why it's been significant for me is that they really understand the need that my company solves. And that's why I've been successful raising funds from them.
They have domain expertise to understand why the customers want to use your product. Interesting.
Correct.
And you are at over $10 million a year in annual revenue at this point, right?
No. So we're at we will be $5 million in revenue this financial year.
Okay.
Five and a half. Yeah.
Five and a half. So now, $5.5 million in annual revenue. You're saying the, you know, overall property market is $50 billion in Australia, $500 billion in North America. What is that market, you know, from a bottom up point of view for you? Like, you know, your market is not the overall property market. Your market is the number of property developers and buyers who are selling, who are buying membership fees on your platform or are paying subscription revenues for your software and service platform. So how big a company can you build out of this niche? What is your TAM, so to speak?
Yeah. This is another reason that the traditional VCs don't tend to like my company as much as I think they should. And that is because there is no data on the full potential market scale of my platform.
You don't need data. This, you know, the bottom-up TAM model is usually not data-driven. It's built on your business model and how many companies are out there. Like, if you were to sell to 100% of your prospect list, how much revenue would you be delivering? That's the bottom-up total available market size, right?
It is, and the question is that there isn't any actual data on the number of participants that there are in the market, no actual accurate data, because it's all out of date. It's not recorded with any government body in Australia, the US, or the UK until it's complete, and then it's 18 to 24 months out of date. However, our conservative estimates that we've done internally are that in Australia, we currently believe we have about 9% of the viable market, and we've forecast that out over the next 3 to 4 years, as well as in the UK, where we believe the market is double Australia, and we've done the same in the US, where we believe it's 10 times. We believe we'll achieve hopefully 10% penetration in the US, hopefully 15% penetration in the UK, and up to 30% in Australia over the next 5 years, and that will make us about a $50 million revenue company at that point.
Great. And it sounds like there is a particular trend that you are keyed into, which is these Chinese and Southeast Asian property buyers who are buying in Australia, who are buying in North America, who are buying in UK. That trend is not just a China to Australia trend, it's a China to United States trend, it's a China to UK trend, and I think that tailwind is in your favor, yeah?
Yeah, it's actually not even just a China trend. It's China, our largest growth market for demand is Asia. Our second largest is the Middle East, and our third largest is Latin America. And the things those markets have in common is that they are wealthy markets, but they are politically and economically unstable. And so the trend that we see is is funds flowing from politically and economically unstable economies and countries into ones that have stable economies, stable governments, and good education and lifestyle opportunities. So we capitalize on that trend by establishing ourselves in both the high demand sell side markets and the high demand buy side markets. And then we find that we not only have a good viable marketplace, but we're now starting to develop network effect, which is lovely, where our customers in say, for example, the Middle East are pushing us into new sell side markets, and new sell side markets that we open up in pull us into new buy side markets like America is pushing us into Latin America. It's no coincidence that we opened in Miami, Florida as our head office. We could have chosen, like any tech company, Silicon Valley, but we chose Miami, Florida, and that's because it's the gateway to South America.
South America, yeah. Now, if you were to look at the timeline of what you have built so far and, let's say, your journey to become a $50 million a year company, what is the length of that timeline? How long from zero to 50 million?
So we have been we've been live for 3 years. We have been commercial for, so we've been charging our customers for just over 2 years.
Okay.
So I suppose you'd say it would be a 5 to 6 year journey from zero to 50.
Okay. So, you know, this is a question that I got recently. You know, I've been doing this video blog on LinkedIn. LinkedIn has just released a new product, a video blogging product, and they've only offered it to the influencers, and I have access to that product, so I've been using it. And I talked about this issue that you were raising, is that your company, the kind of company you're building, is not attractive to VCs because it's, you know, zero to 50 million in 5 or 6 years, whereas VCs are looking to go to from zero to 100 million in 5 years and things like that. And there's a growth rate issue, there's a total available market size issue, and you also explained your analysis of the market size and so forth, and that's something the VCs are not entirely comfortable with, is that is, can this be a billion-dollar company, et cetera. And my take on all that is that what is wrong with this picture? I love the fact that you are going to, you're very steadily executing. You're already going to be at 5.5 million this year. You're growing steadily. Your network effect is starting to kick in. You have a good handle on your customers. Your customers are investing in the company. And you're going to have a very solid, you know, tens of millions of dollars of business in the next 5 years. What if it takes 7 years, even that is fine. What is wrong with that picture? And somebody, you know, so I did a video blog piece on this, and somebody asked the question, so zero to $10 million in what time frame? And my answer to that was, in whatever time frame it takes. Who cares? Your investors would care, but if you don't have investors, one, nobody cares. But if you do have investors, people do want return on investment in a certain time frame. But if you, in a lot of cases, entrepreneurs are building businesses that are not VC fundable, and they'll have to bootstrap. And in which case, if you do not have investors, you can take as long as you want, and who cares? In your case, though, you do have investors, and your customers are shareholders. So what is your game plan in giving them returns? So is this going to be an exit play? Is it going to be some sort of a pub IPO in the Australian market or some other market? Or is this going to be an acquisition? Or are you going to give dividends to your customers?
Yeah, that's the number one question you get asked on a capital raising journey.
Of course.
We don't believe this is a dividend play. That said, we will break even within about 12 to 18 months, and then the company does start to make quite good profits. Mm-hmm. We believe this is an IPO play in the Australian market. Mm-hmm. However, we are also very cognizant of the fact that companies like mine, prop tech companies, are widely acquired by the large B2C portals, and we're in three markets with the most dominant B2C portal players that are very hungry for acquisitions. So personally, I'd love to take this company to an IPO, and that's what I'm planning in the next 3 years. Mm-hmm. We've put the processes in place to be able to achieve that. But I've also committed to my investors that I will not hold on to that dream too fervently if the right opportunity comes our way.
Yeah. And in the Australian market, the thresholds, the size threshold, the scale threshold where you can go public is a lot smaller than in NASDAQ or New York Stock Exchange. So you can take a $30, $50 million company public, and that would be fine too, is what you're saying.
Sramana, companies of my scale are going public on the Australian Stock Exchange. So companies at the $5 million mark or less are going public. Mm-hmm. I personally think that's a mistake. Yes. I think that that ties them up with a whole lot of compliance and a whole lot of red tape that slows down your growth. And I believe at this stage of a company, what you need to be is nimble. You need to be able to make decisions with a small board, and you need to be able to grow. And I think having the financial and regulatory pressures of a stock exchange at this juncture is a mistake.
And your investors have only been in the company for a couple of years, right? You've had investors in the company only for 2 years so far.
2 years. Yeah, 2 years. That's correct.
So you have plenty of runway. You can easily go 5-6 years, you know, let's say 2 years you've already gone. You can go another 4 or 5 years with these investors without them needing an exit or liquidity right away, as long as their return on investment is solid. So you have lots of runway even from an investor schedule point of view.
Yes, we do. We do.
Well, it's really awesome to see your completely different strategy of navigating your company. I'm thrilled that it's working, and I wanted to present this to our audience, and I'm sure a lot more people will be learning about it through listening to the recordings as well. So thank you for coming, John. It was a real pleasure.
Thank you so much, Sramana. Thank you for having me.